It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Interview with Cameron Hurley, Blood, Carnivorous France, and Patriarchy Smashing. Smashing. Let's do that again.
I like sweeping it at Smashing.
Smashing.
Patriarchy Smashing.
And the smooshing of the patriarchy.
No, it's Smashing.
Smashing. No, Smashing.
I think we should leave it at that. That should be the new catchphrase. Smashing patriarchy.
You can change your Twitter handle.
Patriarchy Smasher. That's great. I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Mike.
I'm David.
And we have our special guest today, Cameron Hurley.
Hey! Hey!
So you've written some books.
I have. I've written a few.
Yep, just a couple. Like
just a few.
Yeah, like one and a half.
I'm on
like
four.
Yeah.
I'm on four.
Four? Excellent. But your new book, Mirror Empire,
yep.
Of which there are magic pictures floating around of the map. So why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about the book, but I would actually like to start with what kind of got you to write this book.
This particular book has been kind of, you know, sewing in the back of my brain for quite a long time. I kind of came up with this idea of, and I think something that N.K. Jemisin talks about a lot, where, you know, we have kind of the evil big bad guys sort of stand in for the other. And I said, you know, what we're actually doing is, when we present in a big bad, is we are fighting ourselves. What if we literalize that? What if that was like the literal point of the book was we are fighting ourselves? And that was kind of where things really took off. The world building and things sort of came in a little bit later, you know, with the crazy satellite magic and blood mages and carnivorous plants and amazing things like that. But the core of the book, the big idea was really, okay, what happens when, you know, two worlds come together and one world is going to survive and they need to decide, okay, well, which versions are going to end up living through the apocalypse?
Right, so this is your second series.
Mm-hmm.
What can readers of the Beldam Apocrypha expect to be the same or different in the Worldbreaker saga?
It's different in that I think the Gods War books were a little bit more narrow in focus. We were focusing very much on Nyx, the crazy bounty hunter, and her ragtag team of folks who were going on very discreet sort of missions. This is much more a large-scale, epic, like literally two worlds colliding, you know, cast of dozens. And I think actually I'm at 74 named characters as of right now in the wiki. So what they can expect is, though, also is some of the same, you know, very interesting things with society, gender, world building. The world building's, you know, it's incredible. Listen, it's amazing. If I was Joe Abercrombie, I'd be like, I'm a god of world building. So it was really awesome stuff. So they can definitely expect to see some of the same with that.
So it's a matter of scale. We're switching
sure.
A much larger scale to kind of
yep.
simplify it. Is there, in writing these two very different scaled projects, is there for you a sort of different method you have to approach it to? Or, not obviously like writing itself is generally the same, but I mean, in terms of maybe your thought process for constructing?
Sure. The Gods War books were pretty classic smash and grab plots, right? Like, there is the magic MacGuffin. We need to get, you know, XYZ person and, you know, turn them over to the queen. Very simple plots, which were really great for me because that was not my strength. And it let me concentrate more on the characters and the world building. This time around, I said, you know what? Plot is really not my strength, and I want to work on that. And I worked a really, really long time with my new agent, Hannah Bowman, and we went over and over and over. She had sent me a 17-page edit letter to get this plot right. the plot is incredibly important. We have many, many different folks across many different societies who all eventually will interact, and they all have their own individual arcs. So it was a much more high-level and complicated story that, and again, I've heard you should always be writing the book that you're not quite ready to write, and that was certainly what I felt with this one. I'm like, I don't know if I pulled this off. I really hope I did. But I was definitely challenging myself putting that together.
In what you were describing as the kind of the one of the challenges that you're presenting is approaching the big bad and flipping it around, as you were just describing, and you were just talking about how you're challenging yourself. What are some of the ways in which you think you'd like to challenge the reader with this series?
I think it's a really complicated question because the half of the reading experience is what the reader brings to that experience. So I think that for some people, they're going to come into this and go, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this. This is incredible. And some will come to it and go, I don't know, this is kind of uncomfortable and I'm not really quite sure about this. And I don't know that I have any control. You know, I don't have any control over that. All I can do is say, all right, this is a very similar type of story. Like, you get into it, and it's very, okay, we have an epic big bad. We've got some folks who are coming, some folks who come from, you know, kind of normal backgrounds who find themselves thrust into, you know, the limelight and have to, you know, end up fighting this incredible force. But the other things that I sort of weave in there are maybe not quite as familiar, which to me, I love that. I love that stuff. That's the weird, amazing things that I wish more fantasy did, where I'm like, you know, I wish that we actually explored, like, wow, what if we had, you know, totally different ways, what if we had consent cultures and, you know, matriarchies and egalitarian societies and all of these different kinds of societies working together instead of kind of this fake, you know, pretending like, oh, yeah, medieval Europe was totally this way and it was all patriarchy and it's all about these same guys. It's like, no, that's not epic fantasy. That's not what epic fantasy has to be. And I would love it if somebody, you know, especially a newer writer, you know, read that and goes, oh, wow, this is not, like, epic fantasy isn't all Game of Thrones. It's all not Game of Thrones knockoffs. It's not all Tolkien knockoffs. We can really explore how things in epic fantasy can be very, very different, especially socially and culturally, which we don't do, I think, as much as we probably should.
So building off on that, so this is an epic fantasy, which is very different than the next books. What epic fantasies did you read or have you been immersed in that you see as your forebears in bringing epic fantasy to a new and different place than the typical Western European Tolkien patriarchal BS that we normally get?
I mean, there are writers who are certainly, you know, challenging that. I mean, there's folks like, you know, N.K. Jemisin. Robin Hobb has kind of approached this whole idea of let's look at the life of the catalyst as opposed to the hero who gets all the, you know, you win everything at the end. And in fact, you know, with Hobb's work, it's more like, no, you know, the heroes have a rough time. They're not really the heroes. They're just protagonists. So that's certainly been an influence. And there are other folks, of course. David Anthony Durham does some very interesting work with his fantasy. I especially like the Kushiel books from Jacqueline Carey. She does very interesting things as far as, you know, exploring how, you know, kind of sex is prayer and religion and those sorts of things, kind of challenging accepted ideas of, you know, what culture and society can look like, which I think are very interesting. And, of course, Saladin Ahmed, of course, has thrown the Crescent Moon, which just came out, which is a fun little, you know, sword and sorcery romp, and also, you know, kind of that also a little bit, not epic in scale, but I consider it when I think of fantasy, especially right now as far as current things that are being done.
You talked briefly about weird. To what extent is kind of the weird, all of the new weird, or the older weird, an element in this series or other things that you write?
I'm certainly of the new weird school. I think several reviewers have picked up on that, and that was certainly when I was in my early 20s. That's when new weird was like a big thing, and it feels like China Mieville, K.J. Bishop, who I adore to death, Jeff Vandermeer, of course, who's been a real champion of my work. Those are all really, really big influences. I think when I read Perdido Street Station, I think it was 21, and I looked at that and went, oh, the bar is raised. I was like, oh, this is what we can do. And then, yeah, when you look at Vandermeer, KJ Bishop, and just going, wow, this, again, things can be different in fantasy, which I think about, you know, probably 2006, 2007, I think we saw kind of a shift away from the new weird, which was unfortunate because I love that stuff. I love that prose. I love the weirdness. I love that you're not quite sure what's going on, the supernatural stuff. And mixing all of that together and seeing what comes out is really fascinating to me.
But it seems like the Mirror Empire has material that's placed in cities, but it's not urban in the same way that a lot of the other new weird texts are. Was that intentional?
I don't think it was intentional. I kind of went to it where it was a classic epic fantasy in that, again, we are traveling across, right? We're traveling across different spaces, and a lot of those cities are, like, organic. So they don't seem so much like cities. It's, you've got giant trees that people live in. You have these giant living holds that are, like, you know, constructed through these magical processes. So it doesn't have, there's not, again, there, I think there's sort of this, we have this idea of, like, this Victorian urban steampunky idea of what a city looks like, and these books sort of take a different kind of view of what is a city and how should people live and how are they organizing themselves. And it's very, very different, especially in the primary culture that I look at, which is pretty egalitarian, and they organize themselves by clans. And there's like, well, there's a clan square, and people organize themselves kind of around that. But for the most part, they're very rural and agrarian. So some of that is just exploring different ways that society's work, and also just that kind of a little bit of travelogue nature of epic fantasy. So
that's actually something really interesting, that the focus on, to some extent, how cities might be built based on the societies of which they are part. Because mm-hmm. It's not always something that's addressed in fantasy. Like, we just, like, here's a castle, and, like, some people live around
it. And the fiefdoms and the feudal peasants.
Exactly. But, like, if you look back to the history, my field is post-colonial studies. Mm-hmm. So some of the stuff I do is obviously a little bit more modern than what would be traditional for a fantasy world. But when you look at, for example, the Caribbean islands, the influence on the structures of the cities is largely ideological in construction. They don't just, like, waltz in and say, like, we'll build some random forts and, like, some houses, mm-hmm. right? There's a design to how they are put in place. There's an ideology behind it. And that's not to say that all ideologies behind cities are necessarily negative ones, but there is cities have a meaning, a purpose.
There's a politics exactly. to cities, yeah, that yeah. reflects the societies, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's something that you perhaps explore a little, to some extent, in this particular
Certainly,
novel?
Certainly, I think each of the different cultures in the society, and there's a reason they're so vastly different, which is revealed in the book. But, yeah, absolutely, like, the way that you build cities, the way that you believe people should interact, I mean, that all has to do with, you know, your culture, and how you believe that people should live and, you know, keep, you know, producing more people. So, yeah, it's incredibly reflective in what you end up building as a society.
Excellent, excellent. So, did you?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to branch off on that. One of the interesting things about the characters in the Mirror Empire is that you have a wide range, not only geographically, but also in terms of class and roles. And that's why you talk about what made you choose those very different sorts of characters. I mean, typical epic fantasy is usually winding up in a relatively narrow range of at least a POV protagonist. But here you've gone all over the map. You have mostly women characters, but not all. But they all have very different roles and different origins. What prompted you to pick those particular characters and intersections with their societies?
I think that was definitely also purposeful, right? Like, it came from that whole idea of, oh, they have a fantasy focus on just the noble lords and all the kings and all of that. And I think to some extent, you know, I view this as sort of a bridge book. Like, I want this to be a book that someone reads and goes, oh, yes, I can see those epic fantasy elements that I'm used to seeing, but, oh, holy crap, there's all this other stuff. This is amazing. So it's just enough that you're kind of comfortable, and you see, oh, yeah, there's, you know, the boy who would be king. You know, his sister dies, and so he's going to rule, the people. And, oh, wait, and there's this scullery maid, and, oh, there's this, you know, battle-hardened commander, and her people are at the edge of everything, and there's this other one who's kind of, you know, much, much lesser on the totem pole than the other one. So it was certainly a sort of rebellion against that idea that, oh, we're just We're just going to talk about this one that's just about the Starks, the noble family who once ruled, you know, this whole area. I wanted to get a full view on society, and I think you can only really get that if you're getting all the different levels and pieces of those particular cultures. And that was really important to me, especially coming out of God's War, because in that one I focused completely on they were all people who had no idea all the stuff that was going on above them in the hierarchy. They were very much, you know, sort of the lowest classes of society, living at the very bottom of things and scrambling to try to make a living and survive. And I wanted to keep some of that while still, again, luring in, you know, oh, it's the epic fantasy readers, right? And I'm like, oh, yes, we can get all those things, too, while still exploring the things that really interested me.
Yeah, and just as a slight follow-up, I noticed in reading The Mirror of Power, you seem to like to play with and deconstruct some of the typical epic fantasy tropes as far as those journeys and characters splitting off and doing not quite the expected things. I really appreciated how you wanted to tweak the nose of the standard epic fantasy quest.
Oh, totally. And it's fun, right? Like, that's super fun. One of the things I thought was really interesting, there was an early review where the person was like, I'm really frustrated with this book. It's good, but I don't know who the hero is. Like, I know. Isn't that frustrating? Who knows? Who knows what will happen? Read and find out. Which I think is really cool when someone goes, oh, wow, like, all of these people could be the hero, and I don't know what's going to happen. So,
right, to kind of carry that forward, in the genre, we've had a lot of conversations over the last few years about grimdark, and grimdark is kind of one of the new hotnesses in the genre. And it's like, you know, take George Martin and Joe Abercrombie, and you go farther from there, and like you're obviously playing with a lot of elements, and you're kind of inverting things. Like, what are your thoughts on grimdark as it applies to either of your series, and or broader thoughts on its role in the genre?
I think it's one of those things. I mean, I spent 8 years researching and writing the God's War books. And that, I will admit, got really depressing because it is a society, you know, that's been at war for 300 years. It's really, you know, difficult to live there. But there is something, and I'm trying to remember who did a review. I think it was Adam Roberts did a review of God's War. And he said, you know, I understand why this book appeals to people, because he's like, you look at yourself, and if you are someone who sits, you know, you're in a very civilized society, and you're sitting in an office all day, and you're, you know, confined to always thinking about the future, and, you know, you have the same routine every day, and he's like, this is a character who just goes out and lives on, you know, that gut instinct. I mean, it is Conan. It is the quintessential Conan, where you're like, oh, I just want to live by my primal impulses and go out and kick people in the head and do what I want and, you know, sleep with who I want and be who I want and fight who I want. And it's a very appealing, I think, sort of fantasy, really, for folks who are kind of constrained by those things in our current, like, American, you know, middle class and upper middle class societies. Where they look at that and they're like, oh, wow, this is I completely get rid of all these other things that I have to think about, and I live at a very, you know, emotional level that I can't live in and function, you know, in society. And so to me, I feel like that's some of what Grimdark is about. Some of what Grimdark is about is, you know, in the U.S., we've been at war since, you know, constant war since 2001. And even before that, right, and we had the Iraq War before that. And I think some of that is also a, you know, reflection of that and us sort of dealing with that and that sort of endless grind. So I think, I'll go on record as saying I think people have been talking about it, that we're kind of at the end of the grimdark tale, I would like to say. I think we're sort of seeing it sort of go away just because, again, and having written for 8 years in a grimdark world, I think it is very wearying, and you start to go, you know, is there any hope left? Do we have anything else? You know, where's that shining light? I see certainly the God's War books being within the grimdark tradition. It is a fantasy science fiction sort of meld. It has magicians, it has shapeshifters, it also has spaceships and aliens. They're not the aliens you might expect. So I certainly see it within that tradition. Mirror Empire I thought was really funny because I consider it, like, to be a pretty upbeat book. I like, after Gods of War. After Gods of War, I was like, this is actually, these are egalitarian, there's some egalitarian societies, there's consent culture, there's all this. Oh yes, they're about to be obliterated by this other world, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, it could be so much worse. So for me, it was very, it's very funny to sort of, see some reactions to it. People are like, wow, this is a really dark book. And I'm like, you should read God's War. That was a dark book.
Yeah, there's some really dark elements.
There's some dark elements, yeah.
I mean, you get camps of people getting exterminated.
Yes.
You have the invasion, as you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be upbeat compared to God's War, but it was not shiny happy reading this book. I'm sorry, Cameron. That just agrees. I'm like, oh, wow. And the cannibalism.
And the random ritualistic cannibalism. And I'm like, oh, I'll throw that in there, yeah.
Well, do you think that's... Is that just how the pendulum will have to swing back? That we'll have to have optimism within the darkness rather than trying to go all the way to the other extreme right away?
I think there are certain elements of grimdark that folks assume have to be there in order for it to be grimdark, and that is, you know, a lot of rape and sexual abuse. It's a lot of, you know, all, men being men and women being the things that have done to them. And I think that's some of the things that, and I've been hearing that from, you know, folks, obviously I run those circles, but you're hearing it from folks where that's where sort of the exhaustion is. It's just like, why do we keep telling the same stories about, oh, wow, see how bad things are? I mean, there are very different things that we can kind of explore. The book, really, Mirror Empire is a book about war and genocide. That was, you know, genocide was a big theme. Again, this is my lighthearted book. Genocide was a big theme when I approached it and exploring what makes people who are good people hurt other people and exterminate other people. And that was something I found very fascinating. Throughout all my research, my master's degree was exploring propaganda used to recruit women in the fight against apartheid in South Africa. And that sort of naturally then became, I think, you know, genocide in Rwanda and the Holocaust and other things. And that became something I was really fascinated with, is what happens, you know, when, if you are a culture and you are faced with, you know, do we become the enemy in order to fight the enemy, or do we retain, you know, who we are and try to resist in the face of that enemy? And that is something I'm really fascinated with. And that's some of the stuff that I explore. So is there some hope in that? Certainly. And there's also a lot of me stripping out the things that I don't like about Grimdark, and I did that with God's War too. There's things that you will not see that I think some people associate with it, which is why I think some people say, oh, Cameron, that's not Grimdark. Whatever, there's not enough horrible abuse of people. I'm like, oh, they're horribly abused, just in different ways. So I think that, you know, that's some of the issue there. But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you even wrote about this particular aspect, that this assumption, default assumption, that in order to write Grimdark, women have to have terrible things done to them.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's for some reason, it's like, well, that's just realism.
Yes,
I think you may have even talked about this.
Yes.
It's this sort of like, well, that's realistic, because in medieval societies, women are just raped all the time.
Yeah, and that's just what happens.
That's just what happens. Now, I don't know how true that is. I'm not a medievalist, but I'm going to imagine that if that were true, we probably would have read about it more.
Yeah, the medievalists I talk to, they look at me kind of funny when they ask them, when they're confronted with that, especially the women medievalists.
Well, and keep this in mind too. I mean, this is coming from a tradition of, you know, a history that says that there were only white people in Europe, right? Like, oh, you can't have black people in your Victorian, you know, era. And you're like, right? Like, this is an island with, you know, London was quite a big port city. So these are also the same people who are just like, this is the history I absorb on TV. And I'm like, well, there's a reason you do that, because we are maintaining the status quo. We want everyone to believe that the way we've constructed our society is the only way that society has ever been constructed and we can ever construct it.
Right.
And that's dangerous, right?
It is. And one of the panels that I was on was green is not diversity, I think is the exact phrasing. A really interesting point that we had brought up was this problem of representation, that if what was being represented is actually not what reality is like, then that repeats and repeats, mm-hmm. and media, of course, is a part of the culture. And, you know, whether, even though we all recognize, like, explicitly, implicitly, on a conscious level, that what we're watching is not reality. Like, I go and watch Game of Thrones, I know it's not real, right? But deep down, if you keep seeing those tropes repeated and repeated, you can actually, they can become ingrained. And you start to assume that that's how things really are. And so the same thing with, like, people of color being missing from a great deal of work. I mean, there was the show, did we all talk about this? The Hieroglyph show that got canceled.
Yes. Right, which is supposed to
had a bunch of white people in Egyptian roles. Yeah. Or you had, like, The Last Airbender, where all of the clearly Inuit peoples are played by white people for reasons. And that kind of repeat and repetition and becomes this sort of normality that has to be broken. And it goes to the same thing with the grimdark, the assumptions
that women just tolerated all of these things. It's like with slavery too. I see that all the time. You know, well, slavery, you know, it was, everybody got along and it was fine. And you're like, whoa, what are you reading? You know, the insurrections that happened, they had to put, you know, they had patrols that had to go out all the time to maintain the system. It was incredibly, you know, fraught, and people pretend that it was something else.
Did they read the actual rhetoric from pro-slavery people?
I guess, right?
Because I don't know, like, even if we just take as just for the sake of argument, take and pretend that all of the mean stuff, like the violence against slaves, didn't happen. Like, say all of the their masters were nice. Let's just pretend.
Happy.
Right? They're all nice. But if we go to the rhetoric very clearly is, these are not real human beings. They are not people.
This is
chattel. Psychologically, that is just as damaging as being beaten, etc. So, like, and you can't make that argument and pretend that pro-slave people weren't making these points. Like, you could Google it. It's on the damn internet.
Well, and again, the same, you know, and the laws with women were the same, right? Like, my mom was saying, you know, you couldn't get a credit card without your husband signing on it till like 1970 something, right? Like, it was just, you couldn't buy a house without your husband or your father, you know, co-signing for you until, I think, the 70s or something. It's just crazy where you're just considered this appendage of someone else, and we pretend like that's not going to have repercussions on how we live today. And I'm like, oh no, that's all still there. People still believe this stuff. And we carry, worse, I think, again, like these TV shows and the stuff that we, you know, read and all that. I mean, it's marketing, right? That's marketing from the people at the top who are like, okay, this is how we all want to live and we all want you to be happy. Bread and circuses, and this is always the way society is. We've always been at war with, you know, whatever. So it's a very insidious form, and unless you spend a lot of time trying to break all of that programming that you've been getting from the time that, you know, you were born, it's incredibly hard not to perpetuate it.
Right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Could you perhaps elaborate a bit on what you see then as the potential for genre fiction to not simply reflect the culture from which it emerges, but to shape it?
That's what I want to do. Right. I think the best science fiction and fantasy. And this is a quote I bring out all the time from Joanna Russ, which is, you know, she said, I got into science fiction because I wanted to explore how things could be really different. And I think a lot of the times people are like, I get into science fiction because I want to see this cool little tech thing and just say how awesome it is. I'm like, that is going to change your entire society. For a lot of these technologies, people don't look at how will that affect how people interact and how, you know, economies work. And they don't do those things. It's, oh, they're the people on Mars. You know, the husband is sitting in there and he's reading the paper and the wife is in the kitchen making breakfast. And you're kind of looking at that going, why, how is it, but we're on Mars and it's, you know, this should be alien and amazing and different. And we don't take our imaginations that extra step. We go to a very surface level. And I understand why we do it. It's really hard. I just finished Page Proofs, you know, on Mirror Empire. And I'm going through, it's like, pick a gender, pick a pronoun. Like, oh, what was I thinking with five of these? And you start to think you're kind of insane, the stuff that you're putting together. But for me, it's very worth it because that's what I'm in it to do, where I want to show people you don't have to write the same stories that everybody writes with the same assumptions that everybody has. You can actually explore how things can be different because also that shows people when people, you know, you read a book, and I hear this all the time, you know, if you're a queer person, especially a young person, and you read a book and there's like a queer person in there and they're like living a happy life and things are fine, it's treated as normal, you're like, oh, that's amazing. Like, there's hope in the world. There is a world outside of, you know, the narrow confines of where I live, where that it is possible to be, you know, my life could be different. And I really would like to set work in front of people that they go, oh, wow, look at the possibilities. And I think maybe that's also why I don't consider this totally, totally dark. Because it's very much, there are so many different societies that it is very much, you open it up and you go, oh, wow, stuff could be super different. And yes, they're, you know, in a bad situation right now. But they have constructed a society that's different. Why can't we?
My absolute favorite part of Tolkien's On Fairy Stories is where he differentiates the escape of the prisoner versus the flight of the deserter. And that you have, you know, speculative fiction, fairy stories, and fantasy as a way of imagining a better world.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, the world in Mirror Empire is better in some ways and not as good as others. Mm-hmm. But it's not the thing where people are like, oh, you know, this is just escapist. Like, well, what does escape mean? What are you escaping from? Mm-hmm. And that there's a positionality there. And it's like some of my favorite kind of fiction. So it's cool to get to talk about that.
Yes, too. I mean, in writing any sort of fiction, you're writing about now and today, and the Mirror Empire. Well, you're holding up a mirror to our world and showing, and really showing how screwed up some of our ideas and thoughts are by showing how it could be different. Like, I mean, as you said, you have a whole set of societies. One where there's much more egalitarian. One where the women are really ruling everything, and the poor husband is going to get violated by the women because he's been left alone. I thought, like, oh my god, poor Nava. I mean, if this was reversed, it would just be a lot of typical epic fantasy. But you took those tropes and reversed them, and then he goes up on an epic quest. And in most books, that would be the hero, and he's just like a little side note. He doesn't really get to do anything. I thought, oh my god, what are you doing to this genre, Cameron? But I love it.
All right, that's the pull quote. What are you doing to this genre, Cam?
But I love it.
That should need to go on your SF signal. So we are. Yeah, we've got to kind of wrap up because we're getting close to 10:30. So really quick, tell people where they might find you.
They can find me online at CameronHurley.com, and that is Cameron with a K. Or on Twitter, I'm quite active there, which is just at Cameron Hurley.
Yep, and read her blog.
Yes,
she writes
blog.
Stuff on there.
Once again, we're in a room with all Hugo nominees.
That's right. Mm-hmm. All of us are on the Hugo. Yeah.
And we're not in conflicting categories, so that's good, right?
That's good.
That's always good. We can be friends.
I'm glad, because otherwise they would go to fisticuffs and I would just cower on the ground and just take my beating.
I think she could take you.
Anyone could take me. I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
I'm attempting to not cross the streams of my positionalities and biases while getting someone in the conversation to say an important thing.
And buy Mirror Empire, August 26th.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
You should buy that book. It's cool.
Buy the hell out of the book.
Yes. Yes.
I want Mirror Empire to do for epic fantasy what God's War did for grimdark science fiction. Kick it in the teeth.
Did they get, like, dentures afterwards?
No.
Oh. So it just got, like, missing teeth, just gummers, and just...
Blood.
Blood.
Oh, wow.
Blood.
Guts.
That's blood brutality.
So sad.
Strange satellite magic.
But optimistic blood.
Optimistic. There's a ray of hope among the horror.
Happy curb stomping.
Oh,
happy
yeah.
Portals to other worlds. Meeting your double.
Any case, Mirror Empire comes out through Angry Robot, correct?
Correct.
Correct. I'm just making sure I got it, because you are biased over there, Mike.
Oh, yes. I declared that I would knife fight people, and now I don't have to, because it's coming out, and it's amazing.
Awesome. So, and you said August 26th, correct?
August 26th.
August 26th. So it'll be a little bit after Worldcon.
Yep.
Which means you all are just going to have to save all your money and not spend it all at Worldcon, sorry. Because you need to get the copy of this book.
I pre-ordered it.
You pre-order it, you know?
You could do that, too, right now.
And then
right
that now. Helps an author. Do it
that,
today.
Yeah.
That would help. So, in any case, so thank you, Cameron, very much for your time.
Thank you all very much.
Yep. And thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
I'm not going to thank Paul.
Oh. And that's the awkward ending.
Wow!
Awkward ending. And scene.
Like a butt monkey.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.